This is Jim Inkster. Our guest is Daniel Okrent, the first public editor of the New York Times, the editor-at-large at Time Magazine, and managing editor of Life Magazine, the author of six books, including The Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition, and his latest is The Guarded Gate, which is getting all kinds of attention. And it's about what's going on in our country now, at least the relevance of what's going on, based on what happened a century ago. And a century ago, the immigration issue was certainly vivid and in some not so pleasant ways. What was happening at that time?
Well, the reaction against the enormous unchecked immigration that had begun around 1890 from Eastern and Southern Europe reached a high point among those people who thought that it was going to change the nature of the country in unpleasant ways from their point of view if all these Italians and Greeks and Poles and Jews came into the country. And there had been an effort to stop this influx for 30 years, and it hadn't gotten anywhere. I mean, it had gotten somewhere. Four bills passed Congress four times. They were vetoed by the president, various presidents, until around 1916, the anti-immigrationists hit upon the bogus science, the junk science of eugenics, and there was the effort made to prove that all of these immigrants were genetically inferior and had to be kept out of the country.
Well, in 1921, it was an article in Good Housekeeping that signaled the coming of this law that, as you say, makes President Trump's campaign for immigration restrictions seem mild by comparison. Calvin Coolidge said this: biological laws tell us that certain divergent people will not mix or blend. The dead weight of alien accretion stifles national progress. That was from a United States president. So putting what Donald Trump is saying in perspective, it sounds tame compared to what President Coolidge was espousing.
I wouldn't go quite that far, but I take your point. What Coolidge was doing was picking up on this eugenic idea, this idea that these people were racially inferior. There have been an effort to keep out people of varying what were perceived to be disabilities, blindness, deafness, feeble-mindedness, as it was called in those days, but only beginning around 1916 with the publication of a book that promoted the idea did it change from keeping out individuals whom we wouldn't want in the country, but keeping out whole races. And Coolidge and the rest of the political establishment picked up on this.
What role does Madison Grant play, the founder of the Bronx Zoo? But he was a big player at this time on this issue.
He was the founder of the Bronx Zoo. He was the man who saved the redwoods of California. He was celebrated as America's leading conservationist. And just as he wished to conserve the landscape, he wished to conserve what he called the American bloodstream, which is to say the genetic inheritance of those who came from northwestern Europe, from the UK, Germany, and the Scandinavian countries primarily. And he published a book in 1916, interestingly edited by Maxwell Perkins, the famous editor of Fitzgerald and Hemingway, that argued that these people were inferior and the result of their coming would be intermarriage. And he said that science had proven, though it had not, that when two races, as he called them, intermingled, the offspring would revert to the lower race. The highest European race were the noble Nordics. And if he said if a Nordic married a less than appealing member of the next group down, the Alpines, that the child would be an Alpine. And if the Alpine married a lowly Mediterranean, the child would be a Mediterranean. And if any of the three European groups, he said, married a Jew, the result would be a Jew. And this was his particular campaign that he carried forward.
And this was in America, and it was before Hitler rose to power in Germany. And America, when it comes to these issues, there was no Holocaust, but our hands are not clean, are they?
Not remotely. The feeling about immigrants, negative feeling about immigrants, goes back to the 18th century. Benjamin Franklin really despised the German immigrants who were coming to Pennsylvania in 1750, 1760, and he wrote very angrily about them. This was even before we were a nation. And we've cycled ever since then between periods of the open door of, you know, Emma Lazarus's wonderful poem on the base of the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired poor, your huddled masses," and then cycling into the opposite, which is to say, get out and stay out.
Well, before the law was passed, 220,000 Italians entered the United States. The next year, only 4,000. This had a major impact on immigration, didn't it?
This stayed in place, this law that set national quotas by ethnicity for 41 years. So even though it was, you could say that was really terrible, it reduced the number of Italians let into the country by 215,000 in that 1 year. That was only 1 year, and this stayed in place throughout the horrible depression of the 30s, which was particularly awful in southern Italy, before the American Congress voted down an effort to bring in 20,000 German Jewish children in 1939, before the Holocaust, before the DP camps that spread across Europe, people were kept out by the millions. And it's really a horrible, horrible stain, I think, on our heritage. We were responsible for keeping these people. By keeping these people out, we have to share responsibility for what happened to them.
And a 1939 measure that would have allowed 20,000 German Jewish children into the U.S. died in Congress. So when we get frustrated with Congress today, we have a history. This is 80 years ago of disappointments by some of the high members of the national government.
At that moment, the a woman named Laura Hodling, who was the first cousin of Franklin Roosevelt and whose husband was the Commissioner of Immigration, she opposed the bill that would have allowed the 20,000 German Jewish children into the country. She said, because 20,000 charming children will grow up to be 20,000 ugly adults.
And the Nazis also starved 350,000 Greeks, slaughtered 200,000 Serbs, and these people also would have had very difficult time trying to become Americans at that time.
It was virtually impossible. I tell the story in the book about one family in Poland that tried to get out, and starting in 1936. They got all the papers in order, and when they get to the American embassy in Warsaw, they're told it's a three-year waiting list for people from Poland. This is in 1940, and it was a Jewish family, and we know what happened to them.
Well, eugenics is an idea that has been around for a long time, and you note that Margaret Sanger was instrumental in forwarding this line of thinking. How successful was Margaret?
Well, she was a major figure in American public life at the time, and she did support many eugenic ideas, including the anti-immigration movement. Her birth control campaign would take on any ally it could find, and she was able to take advantage of the fact that the teeming slums, particularly of the major cities of the East Coast and also New Orleans and other places, were overcrowded and they were having too many children, and if we kept them out, we wouldn't have such a problem. What's interesting is that the support for the eugenic interpretation of immigration restriction, it stretched across the political spectrum. There were socialists, leading progressives. The progressive movement of the early 20th century was almost filled with people who took the eugenic view, because the progressives believed in using government and the knowledge of science to determine policy. Of course, this wasn't really science. But they were happy to go ahead and use it anyway. There's Joseph Lee, who was the leading progressive, an incredible donor to every imaginable liberal and humanitarian cause in Boston, who was the chairman of the school committee that wanted the children of the immigrants in Boston to be able to go to school at night to learn English. In his private correspondence, he said, if we continue to let these people in, quote, unquote, we will turn into a Dago nation. At the same time, he was helping them once they got here, and that was a kind of a progressive notion. Keep them out, but if they get here, well, we got to at least civilize them, was sort of the view.
The book is The Guarded Gate, from one of the most prominent writers of this time, Daniel Okrent, over 5 years in writing this book. And you start in 1895, a familiar American political name, Henry Cabot Lodge, whose best friend was none other than Teddy Roosevelt, launched an anti-immigrant campaign. What happened at that time?
Well, he introduced it to Congress with a speech, an incredibly clear speech about saying that these people were inferior, And one way to keep them out would be to pass a literacy test and force them to show that they can read before they're let into the country. It passed Congress, and then in his last day in office, Grover Cleveland vetoed it, and Lodge and his allies continued over the next 20 years to bring it up in Congress every year. And as I had said, they passed it three more times. Then it was vetoed by Taft, and it was vetoed twice by Wilson. And only after the eugenic movement had really taken hold and the ideas of the eugenic movement spread through the country were they able to pass the law and not only have it approved by a president, it was Coolidge who signed it, but they did it by not having to say in the law the name of any single ethnic group, that they use language of science to avoid having to show any obvious prejudice. There was clear prejudice at work, but they hid it behind the walls of science.
We're visiting with Daniel Okrent. His book is The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. And we'll be back after this brief pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster, and we're continuing our discussion for a few more minutes with Daniel Okrent, who is one of the most prominent writers for his time, the first public editor of the New York Times. He was also editor-at-large of Time and managing editor of Life magazine. And for 5 years, he has been studying bigotry, eugenics, and the law that kept two generations of Jews, Italians, and other European immigrants out of America. The book is The Guarded Gate, and for those who think that the immigration debate is new, this is something that has been seared in our society for well over a century, and going back to the 19th century and perhaps even more than that. Why are we so averse to having people come to this country since we are, after all, Daniel Okrent, a nation of immigrants?
It's puzzling. There are many reasons for it, but I would say that the primary reason is the fear that we have of the other and the need to see somebody as lesser than we are. So the same people who came in, whose families came in at the time when it was a very easy to come in before the limits on it from these European countries, their grandchildren are saying, close the door today. It's a different circumstance. I don't want to compare what was going on in 1910, 1920 to what is going on exactly today, but I think the motivation is fear and disdain for the other.
And it's something that continues. Certainly a prejudice against people of the Jewish tradition continues in this country, but it's been around for a very long time. What is the genesis of this?
I think that it is that notion of it's somebody else. I mean, one can go back and say that, you know, the thought that it was the Jews who killed Christ maybe was the originating notion behind anti-Semitism. But, you know, it's a long and complex history we don't have time to go into right now. But I will say, I'd like to read you a couple of quotes from a 33-year-old woman writing in the early 20s about her social life. She had been to a party and said she'd met this Harvard professor who was an interesting little man but very Jew, and said she'd rather be hung than attend another Jew party where she had been appalled by all the talk, she said, of money, jewels, and sables. And that woman was Eleanor Roosevelt, the very model, the paradigm of tolerance in this country. She changed her mind, but she grew up in that world of the upper classes of the Northeast, where anti-Semitism and very many other antis, was normative. It would have been surprising for a wealthy Northeasterner, Episcopalian largely, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, to not be an anti-Semite. It was so accepted as normal behavior.
When Congress started debating the immigration legislation of 1924, a 35-year-old inmate in Landsberg Prison in Bavaria was Adolf Hitler. How was he influenced, if at all, by what was happening in the United States?
You know, he actually writes in Mein Kampf, in his My Struggle in English, his book that explains his theory at great and painful length, that he admired the Americans for keeping out these lesser immigrant groups. He knew this in 1924. He knew this when it was happening. And then later, as he rose to power, he relied entirely on the eugenic science, the so-called science of the eugenicists, that had been developed by both American and German scientists working together over the previous 30 years. They were very close with one another. I don't think a lot of them had any idea where it was going to go, but Hitler was very able to pick it up. He praised Madison Grant spoke about him in speeches, said we needed to do things the way that the doctors, the eugenic doctors, told us to do them. And that begins his horrible, horrible assault based on race.
How did the United States avoid becoming like Germany?
Well, one of the interesting aspects of this is that the genetic research was financed by leading American institutions, from by the Rockefeller Foundation, by Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, the Harriman Foundation, the American Museum of Natural History. And as they saw what was happening in Germany, they said, uh-oh, we're kind of responsible, or we're at least guilty by association with this. And they saw suddenly what the end product of eugenic thinking could be. It ended in euthanasia and then in mass murder. And they ran from it. They dropped it, and eugenics really disappeared from the American conversation around 1935, 1936, 1937. Many of these men who had promulgated it, who had put it forward, they embraced the Nazi doctrine. One of them, Harry Laughlin from Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, actually received an honorary doctorate from the University of Heidelberg because he was such a forerunner of America's racial policies that were now in effect in Germany.
You refer in a book, in fact, there is a chapter about it, 6,346,856 inferior immigrants. Tell us about this.
Well, this was a statement made by the Secretary of Commerce and Labor, James Davis, that he actually had made a count. How he made this count, nobody knows. How he had that exactitude, nobody knows. Of the people that he deemed, and his allies deemed, inferior, who had come into the country under the liberal immigration laws of the preceding couple decades. And he held this up as a flag and as a warning. You know, over 6 million people. We've got to stop this now. It was the sort of thing that enabled them, without ever saying Italian or Pole or Greek or Armenian or Jew, to change the law. They said it's these inferior people. And then the way that the law was put into place, it was quotas by country on these inferior people.
How much of what we're experiencing today is a residue of what happened a century or more ago?
The residue is the idea, the fear, the conviction that we are better than they, and they will make us worse. The they has changed. Then the they was Jews, Italians, Greeks, Armenians, Bulgarians, so on and so forth throughout Eastern Europe, Eastern and Southern Europe. Today it's Muslims and Latin Americans. It's the same sort of argument, but without the patina of science covering it. Instead, it's a patina of fear of crime, effect on the economy. These may or may not be real reasons, but the point is it all arises from the fear.
Well, The Guarded Gate is a remarkable read, and it is an important book, significant for this time, and a glimpse of our past in the United States, which is not as rosy as it is often depicted. And Daniel Okrin, as I mentioned going in, is one of the most versatile writers in America. And for those unfamiliar with this fine gentleman, you, Daniel Okrin, are the inventor of Rotisserie League Baseball.
You're really going to make some enemies for me. I'm despised by the wives of America for nearly 40 years. Yeah, I plead guilty.
1979. How did that happen?
I was bereft of baseball in the cold New England winter, and I had an idea, and I can't say that it came from anything particularly notable, but I talked a bunch of my friends into playing this game where we would pretend to be general managers of ball clubs, and we would pick players, and based on how they actually performed, we would have our own pennant race. It got fairly popular fairly early through the 80s, but when the internet hit, it absolutely took off, and there are people who've estimated that it's a $4 billion industry in the U.S. today, and of course I've become a fabulously wealthy man for having created it, which is to say I haven't made a penny because the rules are so easy, but I'm not complaining. My life's been okay.
Well, It's a big part of our culture, thanks to you. And you also launched the career of one Bill James. And for those of us who are baseball aficionados, Bill James is as important as the name of Barry Bonds. He was the champ. And
well, I'm glad you recognize that, because the things I did in baseball, I was a baseball writer for several years. What I'm proudest of is finding Bill James living in a tiny house in Lawrence, Kansas, and writing an article about him for Sports Illustrated.
And lastly, Okrent's Law. The pursuit of balance can create imbalance because sometimes something is true.
This came from my period when I was the first public editor of the New York Times, and the constant need of newspaper writers and editors to say on the one hand and on the other hand, so that if somebody says the moon is a celestial body that orbits the Earth, and others say, no, the moon is a big chunk of green cheese in the sky, you have to say both sides of it, even if you know that the latter is not true. It's called the law of, it's called the problem of false balance. Somebody says Darwin has proven evolution, but somebody else says otherwise. I think you have to say what the other people say, but you do not have to credentialize it the same way that you credentialize something that you know to be true.
Daniel Okrent, an honor and pleasure to talk with you, and congratulations on The Guarded Gate.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.